Welcome to our monthly conversation with Konstantin, who is one of the most respected voices on YouTube about what is happening inside Russia. Konstantin Samarlov is a well-known YouTuber whose channel Inside Russia comments insightfully on Russia's descent into authoritarianism over the last few years. And of course, we've seen a dramatic escalation of that since the start of the full-scale war in Ukraine. Now, like many others, he's outside of Russia with no idea of when or even if he can return there. If you like this video, please do subscribe to the channel, share it around with friends and family. It's never been more important than it is now to support Ukraine and to understand what is happening in Russia and Ukraine. Please do also comment on the video to help it rise up in the rankings in YouTube. It's very important these days, and it really does sort of help new people discover the fantastic work. And if, in the unlikely event, you're not yet subscribed to Konstantin's channel, go and do that straight away and then come back and watch this video as well. Konstantin, welcome to Silicon Curtain.
Jonathan, thank you very much for having me. It is a pleasure of having a conversation with you today, and it's always a pleasure to be a guest at Silicon Curtain.
Well, I absolutely, the feeling is mutual there. When we started these, I was always worrying about whether we'd have enough to talk about. What we end up doing actually is out of the dozens of potential topics, we end up spending our time just picking the ones we think are most important and which sort of talk most directly to our experience and expertise. So out of the dozens of things we could tackle, we are going to address in this episode, number one, the floods that are taking place. Because I think superficially, it's very dramatic. Thousands of homes are flooded, but actually there's some real depth to this story and some interesting angles. What's your impression when you first started to see the clips coming in about the Orenburg floods?
Well, this is a catastrophe, definitely catastrophe. It has affected so many people. And every time I see the floods, the first thing that jumps into my mind is the Ukrainians. Basically, what Russians in Orsk, in Orenburg, in Tomsk are going through right now, that's what Ukrainians have been going through for over 2 years now, even much worse, okay? Flooding is not shelling. So flooding is not aggressor's army coming in and destroying cities and villages. So that's what I think. The first, every time I see these pictures of this disaster, natural disasters. And another thing I think is that it's ironic. It almost seems like the nature is rising up against Russia.
Yes. But of course, there's something more prosaic going on here, which is that the focus of both central government and indeed local government is not on protecting its own citizens or investing in infrastructure, education, dams, whatever it happens to be, roads, railways. That money is not going towards that. It's going towards the war, of course. So on the one hand, it may feel like karma. On the other hand, there's a very direct explanation why things are falling apart in Russia.
Well, Jonathan, it's very easy to explain. I think it's obvious. You see, every government has a focus. Any government and any country has a focus. And if it's a good government, if it's a democratic country, the focus is on maintaining or improving well-being of people. And what's happening in Orsk is just that. If you know that you have ice breaking every single spring at the same time, then you certainly do something to protect the citizens, right? That's if your goal is to protect the citizens, to keep the citizens safe. But well, Russian government's goal is absolutely different. There's a war going on and it needs to win the war, and all resources are thrown to the war. Resources, monetary resources, obviously, and human resources, people. So there's not too many people left to do maintenance, not just the dams, bridges, but everything else. And we saw the catastrophic events happening in the winter. Now they just continue happening for the same reason as lack of maintenance and lack of people. And it'll be happening even more in the upcoming summer. There'll be fires. And then next winter, it'll be happening because Russian government, it's focused someplace else, not in Orsk, not in Orenburg, not in Russian cities. They could care less.
And we saw that in the summer last year, didn't we? We saw huge wildfires taking place. Now, these happen a lot. They tend to happen every summer. But as you say, there are resources. There are helicopters. There are specialists who can try and at least contain those. Do you think a lot of the specialists, not just fire control, but flooding control specialists, have been sent to the war? Because we know that the heating engineers, certainly, you know, many of those would have been sent off, hence, you know, the episode we did about the crack pipes in the winter.
In Russia, it works this way. The lower you are in the hierarchy of you know, careers of Russia, so to speak, the less you're protected from being mobilized, from being sent to Ukraine. So we're the first places that the mobilization officers came on September 22nd to the maintenance companies in large cities, not in Moscow, not in St. Petersburg, but in large cities, and to the farmers. Because those folks are usually in the dark. They, you know, don't know how to defend themselves. They don't know laws. And basically, that's who they took. And a lot of them have been fighting in Ukraine for 2 years now, and a lot of them are dead. The higher you have climbed on the ladder, let's say you are educated, you have high education, you are in the IT industry, in the energy, the more chances you have to avoid mobilization to get so-called bronь. Okay, that's a paper saying that you cannot be mobilized because you're needed. Basically in the, not in the war, but in the economy of Russia. You're needed in the military industrial complex and so forth.
And that's it, of course. Those people are going to be at a premium, those who are working in the metallurgical industries and those that are working in industries that export. We'll come back to them in a minute because, of course, there's a lot of interesting stuff happening with oil. But there's another aspect, isn't it, that some of these flood defences, and especially the images of the dam disintegrating in Tomsk, some of these defences are not necessarily decades old. Some are built relatively recently in the 2000s and yet have crumbled against forces that surely they were built to withstand. So is it important at this point not just to talk about the pressures of the war, but also the longer-term implications of an autocratic regime, which is rampant nepotism and corruption? It would seem that this really does shine a light on some of the systemic issues that are associated with Putinism.
Jonathan, it's what's happening right now is a showcase. Okay, I'm just going to give you one example, and I think it explains everything about today's Russia, Putin's Russia. Now, you've seen the footage of this dam in the city of Orsk that was destroyed. It was constructed in 2010. So dams are designed and constructed to last for many decades, 50, 60, 70 years. So this one in Orsk was a baby dam, 14 years old. And it was destroyed. And when the general contractor was identified, he was found and he was asked live in one of the TV shows, what do you think happened to it? I said, well, the only thing I can think of is rodents. They made a tiny, tiny hole, just 3 centimeters wide, and that's it. It destroyed the dam. Well, that's one case. Another case, city of Orenburg, which is not far from Orsk, there is a gated community with expensive houses there. And it was under threat of being flooded, just like other houses, right? And people there came up with 3 million Russian rubles, which is roughly 33,000 US dollars. And they hired a company, construction company, real quick, and they created their own dam. Somewhat similar, not really a dam, but bunch of earth, dirt, you know, in a certain way. And that has saved their houses. It stopped water. That construction that they did for $33,000, it actually saved the properties, saved lives. Four people died so far because of the floodings, right? So, and that dam in Orsk was constructed for $33 million US dollars. That dam in Orenburg, made by people, cost $33,000. Okay, and you see the difference?
One does the job and the other one doesn't.
One of them doesn't. Well, it did a job for a few years, but it expired well beyond its before its expiration date, so to speak, you know. And then basically it explains, and the end of the story is this: people, they were celebrating, they're saying, united we stand, or we can do so much together. And all of a sudden, local government came to them and started threatening, saying, you constructed this without getting our permission, without getting license or something like that. So these people who did that, who saved their lives, who saved their properties, now they're facing prosecution from the government, okay? And that just shows you how the system works. It shows you that power in Russia, you know, Putin's system, has one goal to... Well, two goals: to hang on to for the power to last as long as possible, and to enrich everyone who has power. That's it. They don't care about anything else, really. They steal. That dam in Orsk, I'm pretty sure that every single year, local budget allowed for some amount of money to inspect, to fix, you know, to upgrade if necessary, and so forth, and that. Everything was done on paper, okay? And just in Orsk and in other places as well. Just on paper. In reality, that money was taken and transferred to Dubai, to London, to, you know, Miami, to south of France. It's actually your neighbors, probably some Russians, who stole money and went to London. They love London. Because it's one of the best places to live.
It absolutely is. And I live in Oxford. You get a lot of, I would say, language students here. Some of them, I think, quite clearly are the offspring of oligarchs. And they don't have a care in the world. And, of course, they certainly won't care about what happens to people in Orenburg. When the contractor who built the dam came out and started talking about rodents, I was fully expecting him to say, yes, of course, these were Ukrainian genetically engineered bio rodents.
Me too. So that's, yeah. Me too.
And maybe, me too. Maybe they are. No, but I mean, Ukraine hasn't got a track record of tackling, you know, hitting civilians. So I think that's important to sort of point out there. Ukraine strikes military targets and seems to put a lot of effort into doing that. But one really extraordinary thing about this story of the floods is seeing some of the local residents berating and shouting at local politicians. There were some fairly lively scenes with some, I would say, fairly fruity language directed there as well. And of course, some people watching that would be thinking, finally, you know, we can see Russians rising up against their rulers. They're going to take back power, etc. But there's a difference, isn't there, at the obelisk level, local officials. And that's kind of different, isn't it? Directing your complaints at that level rather than directing them at the system in total and higher up. Could you explain what the difference is and why this isn't going to end in a popular uprising?
There is a very good example of what happened in Orenburg. They were protests. And of course, Russian propaganda, Russian TV did not show the protests. Okay, but thank goodness we have cell phones that can film, and we have Telegram where we can share whatever we film. Okay, so they were protests, and it's not fakes or anything like that. It's real things happen. And there's a large crowd of people, and they're going after the mayor. The mayor gets out in front of the crowd and starts answering very uncomfortable questions, and people are extremely angry. And what he does, he runs away. Literally, he just runs away inside of the administration building, the mayorate. And then people meet the governor of Orenburg, Orenburg province, and they also have very tough questions for him. But the very same people stand in front of the mayor's office, mayor's building, and it's the main square in Orenburg. In Orsk. And what do? They are begging Vladimir Putin to help them. They literally, like a 100+ people standing there and chanting, Putin, помоги, Putin, помоги, Putin, help, Putin, help. The very same people who are very angry at the mayor, are very angry at the governor, they're begging Vladimir Putin to help. Russian mentality is the czar is good, and the czar servants, you know, the nobility, they're bad.
And that's a problem, isn't it? I mean, this is
that's a huge problem. Yes,
it's a systemic problem as well. I mean, it's the system itself that over decades is causing. In fact, nepotism and corruption are the grease that make the wheels of this system turn. So these kind of local criticisms, unfortunately, are not going to result in any change. It's a systemic change. And we've talked a number of times about what's required. I'm not sure anyone has actually properly articulated a solution or a path towards it.
I am certainly still looking for one. And it is a systemic problem, but I think it's even more of a mental problem, psychological problem, okay? If somehow people will address that and change inside, they will take that inner change to the outside, definitely.
And talking of systemic things, Ukraine, I think, seems to have hit upon a winning strategy, but it's one that's made the US incredibly uncomfortable. And unusually, it seems that some European allies are not quite in agreement with the US. And that is the Ukrainian decision to hit oil refining capacity. Now, we know that there is a dual use here, that some of those fuel oils that would come out of the refineries that are being hit would be used in the civilian economy, but they are also instrumental to the war machine and to keeping all the engines of war moving, the trucks, the cars, the tanks, etc. So Ukraine believes that by hitting Russian oil refining capacity, it hits revenue-generating capacity for Russia, but it also, even more importantly, hits the ability of Putin to continue the war. Now, this seems to me a very smart strategy. It's exactly the strategy the British and the Americans adopted in World War II. You know, German oil facilities were absolutely, you know, top five in terms of the targets we were going after. In this instance, of course, the US are very uncomfortable because they think it will affect global oil prices. And that it will make the re-election of Biden more difficult. Also, there's a subtext here that I think Berlin and Washington are absolutely terrified about Russia losing the war too badly and it forcing some form of collapse and chaos. But from, because I know you're familiar with the oil industry, does 12 to 14% of the capacity being taken out, which is the current estimates, is that going to have a real impact? Or does Ukraine need to carry on with this strategy to really make it count?
It is a very effective strategy. And I think what Ukraine done has done so far is the crippled, not only Russian civil economy, but well, hasn't crippled much the military, because I think no matter what, they gonna find fuel for the military. Okay, they will strip Russian people of fuel. Okay, there will be shortages at the gas pumps, but there won't be any shortages. You know, to fill up tanks and planes and so forth. But that's a huge impact. First of all, Russian companies cannot export the products of refining, oil refinement anymore. Not like it was a huge part of exports, but still, that's something that was bringing US dollars into Russia, into oil companies. Now they cannot do that. Okay, they certainly are not free to set up their own prices when they sell to the military. And don't forget that Russia is entering spring in the time where agriculture needs a lot of diesel fuel to start planting, you know, crops such as wheat and so forth. And then I think this industry is going to suffer a lot. So the effect of what Ukraine has done is seen right now, okay? And Russians won't be able to restore the oil refining capacities that easily. You know, don't quote me on that, but I think more than half of the capacities that were taken out of operation have not been fixed, and most likely it won't be fixed for a long time because there are problems with procuring spare parts, procuring some engineering and so forth, because Russians don't produce anything by themselves. They import everything. Okay, and I think the most important effect will be prices, wholesale prices of gas and diesel have gone up already. And the reason we're not seeing the price hikes in at the gas pumps in Russia is because they were sugarcoating the situation and forcing oil companies not to hike prices before the elections. Now the elections are over. The prices, actually, this is the first week we are seeing the price increase at the pumps. And, oh boy, get ready. It's going to get nasty.
Going to get painful.
Gas is going to get much, much more difficult. It's like a multiplier effect. It's going to influence the economy. It's going to influence the cost of things that are produced in Russia. Not too many, but still they produce, basic things and things like that. So Ukrainians have been very effective. If I was them, I would continue.
And of course, some of those spare parts, China is not producing potentially those advanced spare parts for oil facilities.
No. China is not a big oil producer. Therefore, it does not have technologies in extracting oil. And it does not have technologies to refine oil. Okay, for the reason is they just don't have oil. Okay, they can buy some from the U.S. companies, the holders of the technology, the ones who invent technology. But it's a very thin ice because Americans know where the technology might go to. They monitor. They check, and the Chinese can get into trouble. So they probably can get very basic stuff, but sophisticated things, no. So it's, and I believe that some of the oil refineries have been put out of operation, and they're going to stay out of operation for a long time. Not all, but some.
And it seems that the Russian government has now approached Kazakhstan to try and fill what one imagines is some gaps in supply. That, of course, shows a certain amount of desperation, I think.
Absolutely. It's approached not only Kazakhstan, but Belarus. But you see, Kazakhstan, Russia must ask and beg for. Belarus, it can simply order. it can tell Lukashenko, hey, we need this in this. And Belarus has a lot of reserves in terms of oil refining capacities. It has, I think, two large oil refineries that can use to produce extra, to refine extra petroleum products. Will it be enough? Probably not. And Russia has not started procuring anything from Kazakhstan, but they are asking. They have asked. I'm not sure what Kazakhstan reaction will be, because tensions between Russia and Kazakhstan are rising.
They are. I mean, I unfortunately occasionally watch clips from sort of Zed Patriot channels and so on. And there's a lot of deeply troubling sort of hatred being broadcast. Also, there have been deputies in the Duma openly talking or threatening Kazakhstan with similar treatment that obviously Ukraine has undergone. So it's concerning that Kazakhstan may be, you know, a target for a future special operation.
Jonathan, it happened not just with some deputies. It happened with one of the powerhouses, General Gurulev. Okay, he's a powerhouse senator. And he wasn't openly, what's even worse, he wasn't openly threatening Kazakhstan, but his telephone conversation was eavesdropped and made public, okay? And then he was telling in that conversation that, you know, Russia's going to take Kazakhstan sooner or later, but it's a done deal. It's a decision that has been made. And we're talking about one of the most powerful senators, he's a former general. Putin had just made him a member of an important board. This is bad. And I'm pretty sure that Kazakhstan will be taking measures against that, okay? In Uzbekistan, there was a big storm when a Russian official, well, semi-official, Z-Patriot Prilepin, Zakhar Prilepin, he's a member of a public committee overseeing the Ministry of Defense. So he's not like a official, but he's known for his views, and he's a member of some kind of organization, the Committee of the Generals. And when he said that Russia needs to take Uzbekistan and have everyone, make everyone speak Russian in Uzbekistan, Uzbekistan went irate immediately. Okay, it was not an official statement. It was more of a informal sharing of his thoughts of a pretty famous guy in Russia, Z Patriot. But the Uzbeks, they have taken it very seriously. They have summoned Russian ambassador. They gave the Russian ambassador a note. And they started coming up with a strategy. The president himself came up, said, oh, you know what, it's too much Russian language in Uzbekistan. We need to go back to our roots. Uzbek language needs to dominate TV and so forth. And then that's been a clear change in direction from Russia away from it. Okay, so in Uzbekistan, it's even worse. I mean, that's what happened in Uzbekistan. In Kazakhstan, it's even worse. And it's not Kazakh's fault. The Russian senators are telling them that. This is crazy. I'm sorry, I got carried away.
This is an important topic. I mean, my fear is, well, we'll come to mobilization, I think, is one of the big topics we're covering this episode. But
let me finish this topic, okay? This is what happened to me personally. I've never had any problems speaking Russian here in Uzbekistan or being Russian, being a foreigner. Uzbeks have been absolutely wonderful to me and to all Russian refugees, okay? But when that guy came out and said what he said, of course, Uzbek politicians just went absolutely mad. And it was on TV, they were discussing it. And we attend every morning, we go have breakfast. You know that I've founded Tashkent Breakfast Club, where Russians meet, the ones who have left Russia, and Ukrainians will try to make amends. You know, we have breakfasts, we live, okay? We try to fix what was broken and heal. So the waiters know me because I've been attending the same place for about 18 months now. Very nice. They're very friendly to me. We're friends with the waiters. And this one girl, and she's probably, you know, 21, 22 young, very nice. She comes to me in tears and she says, "Konstantin, why would you do something like that to us? What did we do to Russia? Why the Russians want to come and take our land and enslave us and, you know, make us speak Russian? I mean, we all speak Russian, but why do you have to make us, like, what is going on? Why do you have to invade and enslave us?" And then she was in tears. So it tells me that the Uzbek people have taken very seriously what Zakhar Prilepin said. Okay, no matter what they're saying in Russia, oh, he's a nobody, and he's a nobody there, but he's a somebody here in Uzbekistan. And oh boy, these people are mad and scared.
And rightly so. I mean, they will see what's happened in Ukraine, and they'll see how just a few years before 2014, you know, people would have described that as a brotherly relationship, etc. But this leads me on to the topic of mobilization, because my big fear is that if Putin starts to run out of people before he starts mass mobilizing the population of Moscow and St. Petersburg, which he's going to do as a last resort, because that genuinely, I think, is quite dangerous for him politically. He may look to easier territories like Kazakhstan for other recruits or forcible recruits, and of course, resources, oil, and all the rest of it. So it's a massive concern. But if we turn that into this idea of mobilization, we've got May the 9th, Victory Day coming up. We have, of these highly symbolic holidays, we know that Putin still has huge ambitions. I don't know if he still has an ambition to take Kiev, even though that's pretty unreasonable. It now looks like he wants to take Kharkiv. But with the current state of, you know, the amount of forces he's got, it seems unlikely that'll be the case. So will he go for another mass mobilization? Will it be the so-called skrytye mobilizatsiya? Will it be the sort of hidden mobilization? What is he going to do to get the bodies he needs for further victories in Ukraine?
Well, it's a complicated question, but it's crucial to understand what's happening in Russia. I suggest everyone starts thinking differently about mobilization in Russia. It's not going to be the same as it was in September of 2022. That mobilization was a mistake, and I think, I'm sure Russian authorities understand that. What happened in September and October of 2022 is they weren't any tools for Russian government to be effective mobilizing people. So they started mobilizing in the old ways. They started writing paper summons to people and catching people with policemen and mobilization officers. And people were hiding, they were running away, they were fleeing, they were, that over around 3 million people have fled Russia since 2022. Their mobilization was not that effective. So, and they understood that, and they started changing things. It almost seemed like before October of 2022, there was no one body of the government responsible for mobilization and for, you know, recruitment and for all actions of stocking army with people. But then I clearly remember things changed on, I believe it was October 7th, because all the news, you know, Russian news, they did not have a set of rules how to broadcast mobilization. So every channel, every newspaper, they were saying everything they wanted to. They were showing how the policemen were catching people and it was working against the government. And I remember everything changed October 7th. Narrative became unified among all the propaganda people, propaganda media. And a lot of work started being done to change legislation, mobilization legislation, because back then we had old Soviet mobilization legislation, and they have changed it, and they've made it very effective. And now, not Putin, but anyone else need not to announce or create another wave of mobilization, so to speak. Mobilization in Russia is permanent now, and they've made it so it is covert, stealthy. You see, the problem with the previous one was that people saw what was happening all over Russia. They were sharing videos. There was a website. It's actually in real time. It was monitoring the streets of big cities and telling people where the policemen were catching people or doing manhunts, you know, subway stations and so forth. Now, mobilization looks like this. There's one unified database. And for example, before they give you a summon, paper summon, saying you have to turn yourself into mobilization office in 3 days, within 3 days. Well, you throw that summon away, you get your backpack, you run to the airport and buy a ticket on the nearest flight out of Russia. And when you go through passport control, they don't know that you have been summoned, okay? Because the databases were absolutely different. Now they have unified all the databases. There's one body of the government in charge of, that's KGB, in charge of mobilization information and so forth. And all they have to do, according to the law, this new law that they adopted, all they have to do is to put your name into the database. They don't even have to notify you. But once your name is in there, you are not allowed to leave Russia anymore. Within, I think, seven or 14 days, 1 or 2 weeks, they revoke your driver's license. You cannot sell or buy real estate, property. And I think they have a right to close your bank accounts, freeze your bank accounts. So basically, once they want to mobilize you, all they have to do is to put your name on into the database, put like a little flag, mark it, and that's it. And you will come to them because you won't be able to live. What, do you have to go? Will you go to the woods and hide there for the rest of your life? You need a driver's license. You need to use your, you know, bank cards, bank accounts. You need to... If you own a company, you cannot do anything with your company. You are stripped of right of doing business, things like that. So they don't need to announce anything. They've been doing it. Now there's information coming from different migrant workers. They made a new law that once you become a citizen of Russia, let's say you come from Uzbekistan, then your Uzbek driver's license is good for 1 year. After 1 year, you must come to DMV, local Department of Motor Vehicles, and it's called GIBDD in Russia. And actually, you have to replace your old driver's license with a new one. And they adopted that law a year ago, and now thousands and thousands of freshly minted Russian citizens from Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, you know, they need to have driver's license. So they go to DMV and they're recruited there. They're caught there. They sent to war because they're new Russian citizens. And now they have responsibility just like anywhere else. You know, the things like that are happening already. Vladimir Putin approved expansion of military armed forces, Russian armed forces, by 300,000 men. Shoigu suggested and Putin agreed. He signed a paper. So Russian military will expand by 300,000 people. Why 300,000 people? Because they need to, for one, replace those who were killed in Ukraine, and two, to rotate some who are just going crazy after 2 years in the front lines. There you go. Where are they going to get 300,000 people? Well, obviously, they're going to mobilize them, but now no one knows because there are no policemen knocking on your door. Nothing like that. They made it stealthy, they made it effective, and they made it the way that people go themselves. So this is my take on mobilization. It's going on, and it's going to be intensifying. But unless we look closely, I'll be monitoring. You can trust me on that. You know, I'll be looking very closely. And of course, they won't be able to hide it completely, but it's not going to be so public and open. It's not going to agitate people so much as it did a couple years ago. Especially now, lots of Russians living in their bubbles, informational bubbles. And they're going to hear about mobilization someplace far away, but that's not going to touch them much, you know. So this is what I think of the mobilization.
It sounds entirely plausible. And before Navalny's funeral, I was essentially said on the channel, look, what's going to happen is anybody who turns up to that funeral, even though, you know, it was relatively private mourning rather than public protest, I said, look, they're not going to arrest them in the street on the day and create a scene for the cameras. They're going to use the facial recognition system, which now maps the entire central part of Moscow. They're going to map those faces. They're going to use multiple databases to, you know, to triangulate where those people live. And then they're going to pick them up there. And this is exactly what happens. People who attended any kind of memorial for Navalny start to get mobilization papers within a couple of days of that happening. So unfortunately, these are fairly predictable, but terrifying steps that the government is already embarked upon.
Absolutely.
There's only one topic, I think, left on our list, and that is Belgorod, because we've seen the incursions that were really prominent during our last conversation. Those have kind of been wound down to an extent, and there is no new announcement around, you know, the Russian Free Legions and their activities. In fact, I think they're taking a bit of a pause to analyze their tactics, analyze the impact of those. But there have been reports from the people in Belgorod, which still comes under, you know, intense bombardment because of the amount of, you know, frontline military bases, logistics, factories, etc., that are getting hit there. The people of Belgorod feel abandoned. And this is the one thing that I find it difficult to imagine, but there seems to be a certain amount of indifference to the plight of the people in Belgorod Oblast, not just from the authorities, but it seems that mentally it's almost a different country for many people in Moscow, and it's not close to their everyday lives. And are the people in that region right to feel abandoned and forgotten?
I will start at a little different angle. Jonathan, I think that the biggest and the most terrifying change that has been happening to Russia, the country, has been happening inside regular Russian people. And you nailed it. They do feel that way. Quite a few of them feel like it's not, you know, it doesn't really concern them that much what's going on. Belgorod is too far away. As long as they're not being bombed, as long as they're not bothered, as long as they're not, you know, their regular life is not affected and is not changed, they don't care much. Okay, they have built own personal private information bubbles, and that's where they live. Inside their bubbles, life hasn't changed much in the last 2 years. Okay, and when I start asking them questions, well, if Russia is doing well, if everything hasn't changed much, then what's going on in Ukraine? How many people were killed? And then they shut me off. Like, no, we don't want to talk. We don't want to talk about that. We don't follow the news because it's too painful. It's too disturbing. And not just for Ukraine, they're doing it, but now they're doing the same thing for Russia. They have lost empathy for Ukrainians, and they're losing empathy for their own fellow citizens, for Russians, okay? This is a new normal, and I think it's going to intensify. It's going to go further. You see, to fix economy, especially for a country like Russia, rich of different resources, is a piece of cake, in my opinion. It's not rocket science, okay? To change the way the government works also is not that difficult. You need people to rise up and say, hey, we want change. We want you out. We want new people. It's doable. We all know how to do that. The biggest, the worst, the most catastrophic change is them changing inside, them losing empathy, them losing emotions, and you know, they act like as if not human beings anymore. That's what the biggest tragedy that Russians are going through, okay? And you are so right about Belgorod. Belgorod is just the beginning. Belgorod is in a permanent state of war right now. It's being bombed, it's being attacked constantly. And I was just sent a billboard, a picture of a billboard in Belgorod. Guess what's on the billboard? Advertisement of bulletproof vests for children of small size. This is friggin' unbelievable, okay? So people in Belgorod are very upset. But so what? No one really cares. The government doesn't care. Fellow Russians don't care. Life is as goes on, and they claim nothing much has changed. So this is what I think.
I mean, it's extraordinary. I tend to agree with you from the interviews and things that I've seen. 1420 channel does some interesting sort of stuff, talking to people, and it echoes that. It also raises an interesting prospect that if a new Prigozhin or somebody was to march upon Moscow, they may be met with a fair amount of indifference. You know, it's Putin, it's somebody else, who really cares? I mean, this prepares the way, I think, for something potentially interesting to happen over the coming months. I hope very much that we get the chance to analyze, discuss it, and of course to do what we do, which is try and break things down into a very human level and try to propose solutions. I think that's why it's so pleasurable talking to you. One, the precision of the analysis, but also the human dimension and the fact that we are, I think you and I are both constantly trying to look out for materials or ideas that could change the situation rather than just sort of, you know, analyzing it with indifference. I think that's why the audience sort of value these conversations. And so thank you. I really appreciate them as well. And it's always a great pleasure to catch up.
Jonathan, thank you so much for having me. And it is also a pleasure to be on the channel talking to you. Fantastic. I look forward to our meetings. Just to let you know, I think that Russia has entered a period of turbulence, perhaps great turbulence, perhaps turbulence that is going to change country's future. And I feel like Russia is feverish. There are so many news come out every single day. And, you know, I try to monitor all of them, and there's definitely a lot to talk about. I look forward to our next conversation, analysis, and we'll see what happens. But I have my popcorn ready right here, and I'm watching this show I called The Grand Demise.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to watch that with you, but also to keep it very human as well. And I have no doubt that we'll have plenty to talk about in our next conversation in a month's time. Konstantin, thank you so much. Stay safe.
Thank you.